Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Kling, working behind the scenes. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be joined by Daniel Gold, the founder of Future Energy Solutions. We're going to talk about lighting in a retail setting, not only inside the store, but outside the store, parking lots, and the like. We'll talk about the negotiation sometimes that has to go on with landlords of a particular retail setting in order to install some of those lights in common areas. And we'll also talk about things that may not first strike you when it pertains to retail lighting. Just as a background, Future Energy Solutions provides lighting as a service for not only retail companies, but other firms nationwide. And he'll talk also a little bit about what that means as well. In news, we'll discuss a couple of grocery-based stories, and we'll look ahead to something that was released by the Amazon PR machine this week, but might be important in terms of how payments are submitted by customers in the future. A reminder that you can subscribe to us on any podcast listening service that you hear us on. Your subscriptions and your ratings, if you like us, do matter in terms of helping others find us. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. Coming up this next week, I'll be out on business. We'll have a podcast next Sunday, of course, but I'll be visiting Asheville, North Carolina, home of Ingalls Markets. So excited to see a couple of those stores in their flagship area. The week afterwards, be headed back to Montana on business as well. So hopefully put up some interesting retail photographs on both of those social mediums for you. Now, as I mentioned, a couple of stories from grocery this week, and really no notable retail earnings calls, no news jumping off the page by and large. Grocery retail-based research, it's the research really, takes our news segment today. First, let's discuss new research that suggests for the first time digital coupons have surpassed paper coupons. Let's talk a little bit about some background here. You know, during the course of the show, we've discussed the dynamic behind freestanding inserts or FSIs with various interview guests. Now, sometimes we talk about these in terms of coupons issued by basically consumer product groups. Sometimes we're talking about these in terms of the retail ads that are out there. And of course, we just talked last year about how important these retail ads are for retailers and how much people still do look at those freestanding inserts. But for coupons, and as far as those are concerned, they've been the standard bearer for decades, still used with regularity, just not as much over the last couple of years, according to this research. And we should note that this research doesn't touch on FSI ads, but rather, you know, kind of those CPG FSIs that you might see. Well, in 2020, digital load-to-card, or L2C coupon redemption, was greater than redemption of FSI coupons for the first time. This came via Inmar's promotion industry analysis that was revealed this past week. 29.3% of all coupons used at retailers were L2C coupons, those load-to-card coupons, and that's by volume, not by value. Value, of course, you might get a little bit of a different result, but we're talking in terms of just sheer redemptions here. Meanwhile, FSI coupons came in at 28%. Other coupon categories included the increasingly popular store coupons mailed to home. Kroger, in particular, has been aggressive in marketing to customers via mail in this way, especially those that are using their rewards platform and their rewards card. Let's talk about those digital load-to-card coupons, if you will. Those are usually, not always, but usually going to be those app-based coupons that you'll see. You'll see shelf talkers, of course, in stores, on the shelves, imploring you to use the website for a certain amount off a particular product. Also, if you've got it set up, you'll see receive push notifications from those apps about coupons that exist for products that you typically buy. So that's really what we're talking about here, by and large, when we're talking about those L2C coupons. Now these usage numbers come as a result of a substantial rise in those load-to-card coupon uses. Volume was up 27% in 2020 versus 2019. The main question, of course, is Why? So we know that they're taking over market share. Why are they taking over market share? Well, Inmar had some insights there, and this is one of the reasons why we wanted to talk about it here on the show. First, there was a decrease in volume for FSI, freestanding insert coupon use. That's not just because customers were turning away from them, but there was somewhat of a decrease in production as well when you break it down to distribution. So this is the number of coupons that are distributed to customers, not necessarily those that are redeemed at the point of sale. Total coupon distribution via FSI was down 15%, and that's largely a product of decreased newspaper distribution. So as newspaper subscriptions wane, those were kind of the main methods that these FSIs got into customers' hands. Now you're looking at more of those FSI by postal mail to try and reach certain customers. So you're seeing a shift in terms of distribution, but that's also taken down the overall distribution numbers simply because there aren't as many newspapers in circulation currently. Now, the second reason here is that pandemic conditions limited willingness for customers to use tangible paper-based coupons, just like a lot of customers limited use of cash, and we saw cash shortages during the course of 2020, not only in terms of coins, but bills as well. Also limited the willingness for customers to shop in stores, especially early on during the pandemic. As a result, even if these customers had FSI coupons, they weren't getting used, as the customers were using curbside or delivery for groceries where they can't really redeem those as they could in the store. And the numbers bear this out. Coupon redemption volume was down 21% from 2019 in 2020. You look at just the raw numbers from 1.32 billion redemptions to 1.05 billion redemptions. So a pretty drastic decrease in number of coupon redemptions. Of the 200.13 billion coupons distributed overall in 2020, again, according to Inmar data. However, Inmar was very clear here that customers are still interested in promotions. The bottom line is, it's not that customers aren't using these because they don't like to use coupons or don't want to save money. The reality is they're still very interested in promotions. They're just kind of shifting the way in which they expect to use and interact with these promotions. And this comes out in other data there. In fact, their 2021 shopper behavior study from Inmar noted an increasing population of shoppers using digital coupons. When you look at a generation basis, Gen X shoppers said they use digital coupons 69% of the time during the course of the past year, 58%, by the way, for baby boomers. That reflects an 18% year-over-year increase for baby boomers. So honestly, this shifting preference might be an important message to CPGs about how to leverage coupon promotions in partnership with retailers, whether they're utilizing co-op dollars in some way, shape, or form with those retailers, or they're providing retailers with the leverage to make those coupons available through their membership platform, either in app or online. So a very interesting story there, and certainly a major shift in terms of how you think of accessing those coupons and discounts on products in the future. Now, another grocery story comes by way of Produce Market Guide, as a report from the Organic Produce Network and Category Partners shows that organic produce sales continue an upward trend. Well, really no news there, because all grocery has continued a general upward trend and all produce has continued a general upward trend over the past, well, about 15 months. Now, this particular study, though, goes a little bit deeper. It used Nielsen scan data for its findings. And put simply, sales of organic produce via retailers were up 9.3% year over year in the first quarter of 2021. And you might ask, you know, we're looking at the first quarter of 2021 versus the first quarter of 2020. There's only 1 month of pandemic sales in that last quarter. January and February 2020, there was really no pandemic buying trend from grocers, at least not in most of the country. So how does this compare with the rest of the produce section? If we're talking about organics being up year over year, it's really important that we compare it to conventional produce. Well, the number is quite favorable compared to conventionally grown produce. Now, conventionally grown produce sales by dollar amount were up, but just by 2.9%. Compare that, of course, to that 9.3% we talk about for organics, and the numbers are even more stark when you look at volume. Of course, in produce sales, you have sales numbers on a dollar basis, that's what we just talked about, and then volume, measuring basically the amount by unit moving. For organics in Q1, this was up year over year by 5.7%. However, volume for conventionally grown produce was actually down 0.6% year over year. In a way, this is positive for retailers in a couple of fashions. One is we can see just from the raw dollar amounts, they're making more money from less produce. So there's a potential there for either margin growth or perhaps just keeping pace with inflation. And that's something that retail CEOs, particularly in grocery, have been mentioning of late. The other thing is you talk in terms of substitute goods. When customers move up to organics from conventional produce, there is usually more of a margin at hand available for the retailer. And of course, a pop in revenue numbers for the retailer, given that organics usually more expensive than conventionally grown produce. However, I say all that, but the waning volume for conventionally grown produce, that is somewhat worrisome. And honestly, it might create potential eventual sales lags going forward if customers do begin to increase restaurant-based meal consumption again in the future, or if grocers find that they have to discount for some reason, bringing those sales numbers back in line with volume increases. Nevertheless, as far as organics are concerned at least, this is an unabashed positive. Retailers continue to successfully devote shelf space to organic produce. I say successfully because, again, it's borne out in these sales numbers. Organics do have the tendency to be, by the way, a bit more top-heavy than conventional produce. And what I mean by that is the top 10 organic produce categories accounted for 70% of the total organic sales in Q1. So the top 10 types of items overall accounting for somewhere in between two-thirds and three-quarters of overall Q1 organic produce sales, and that's according to this survey. For comparison, the top 10 conventional produce categories accounted for just 64% of conventional sales. So produce versus other grocery categories, you could call it top-heavy, but certainly organics are a bit more top-heavy. In fact, over one-third of organic produce movement by volume in retailers, that's 37%, that's accounted for by just three items: bananas, carrots, and apples. So that's pretty incredible. No surprise, by the way, in the volume and sales breakdown. As a side note, bananas, of course, as we talked about with organics, led on the volume front at 17% of overall organic produce volume. In terms of sales and dollar numbers, packaged salad led the way at 17%. Berries weren't far behind at 15%. Both of those saw an increase between 8 to 10% year over year in terms of sales on a dollar number figure. But lettuce provided the biggest sales jump on a dollar figure, up 34.7% year over year. Pretty remarkable there for lettuce. And once again, lettuce salad mix leading the way. Customers, of course, wary about pesticides potentially being on those leafy greens. And I'm sure the whole to-do about romaine lettuce a couple of years ago has probably accelerated the movement to organics in that space as well. Finally, one last note on this study in terms of regionality. The West and Northeast both accounted for the highest jumps in sales growth. These two regions, historically the strongest for organic produce sales in the U.S. So takeaways here. Again, retailers of all kinds in the grocery space, whether it's a Walmart, whether it's a Kroger, whether it's a Whole Foods who already contributes quite a bit of their shelf space to organics, you have to figure they will continue to contribute shelf space to organics as customers continue to substitute in organic goods for conventional. It was thought, perhaps, at the beginning of the pandemic, a good 12 months ago, 13 months ago, that maybe you would see, because of the recession and recessionary buying habits, people switch their preferences from organic to conventional in an effort to save money. We have not seen that be the case, at least to this point. Very solid numbers from organic produce. And a lot of that, of course, has to do with how retailers are marketing it successfully, I think one could say, to this point. Well, that'll do it for our news segment. Coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Daniel Gold, once again, the founder of Future Energy Solutions. We'll talk to him about the dynamics behind retail lighting and why outsourcing retail lighting needs might be the better option for a retailer if you don't have your own in-house lighting experts. brick and mortar fixtures and installations are always in the back of retailers' minds. Every now and again, you'll hear from a retailer about lighting refreshes at certain stores. Family Dollar's H2 stores come to mind, as do Walmart's lighting overhauls in certain stores a few years ago. However, advances in lighting go so far beyond marginal energy savings and making things look appealing for customers. New lighting technologies can save retailers substantially on utility bills that, let's face it, they are ever growing. Here to discuss the current state of retail lighting and lighting technology is Daniel Gold, the founder of Future Energy Solutions. Future Energy Solutions is a leading provider of lighting as a service for companies nationwide. Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
For reference for our audience, I was wondering if you could give us some background on what Future Energy Solutions does just on the day-to-day.
So Future Energy Solutions is a lighting as a service company. And what that actually means is we go out to the right type of industries and we help them upgrade from old ineffective lighting into new energy efficient lighting by supplying them with their fixtures at no charge. We then install their fixtures at no charge. We actually even maintain their fixtures for the next 15 years at no charge. And furthermore, with the energy savings we create in our company, we allow our customers to retain 25% of those energy savings. They never laid out any capital ever. So they're allowed, so therefore they're able to take their own capital and deploy it back into their own business, which is where obviously they make all their money and understand what it is they're trying to do to entice more business in these very difficult times.
So you've discussed a few parts of it, but I do want to go back and touch on that lighting as a service aspect, because you're talking about no capital outlay for retailers, that type of thing. What's the main difference, or what are some of the main differences between that traditional lighting model and lighting as a service as you provide?
Well, Trent, you have to appreciate that there really is two types of lighting. You've got lighting that's a symptom of somebody's business. Then you've got lighting that is somebody's business. So for example, when you go into a car dealership, for example, and you've got cars that are red and blue and green, it's not just red, blue, and green. There's different hues of those red, blue, and green. And therefore, those lights that they decide to put up can really have a dramatic impact on the customer experience when they come in to view those cars. Now, conversely, you have a different type of lighting where it's just a symptom of your business, where, for example, maybe you walk into a massive Costco or a Walmart, and they've just got white fluorescents hanging by the thousands in the ceilings to guide you down the aisles. They're not displaying their wares the same way. Now, everybody will talk about the energy savings element of energy efficient lighting. But to one customer, there really is energy savings. But for another type of customer, those energy savings are not as important as the aesthetic that client's looking to achieve. And there is the main difference. With lighting as a service, it's about energy reduction. It is not about trying to create those amazing aesthetics that you'll see when you go into one of those type of facilities, as it's dramatically different.
So you mentioned it, you walk into a Costco, you look up at the ceiling, thousands of fluorescents there oftentimes. From someone that's in the industry that does this literally on the day-to-day, what is the current state as you look out of retail lighting? We know that a lot of energy efficient solutions have been on their way, but what's kind of the percentage, or what's the state of brick and mortar retail in terms of them switching to some of these more energy efficient solutions, and where are their pathways to perhaps better their energy usage?
Well, when you're, let's say, for example, a Costco, it's incredibly easy to achieve energy savings, because an energy saving fluorescent tube is just going from one type of wattage, old fluorescent, down to a more efficient LED tube. You'll get the correct white light you want to get out of that tube. Nobody's really reinvented white light. It's just brighter. And you can light up your white store with the white light very efficiently. But again, when you go into a different type of ambient store, like as I mentioned before, let's say, for example, a bar, a nightclub, or a restaurant, they're all retail, so to speak, or a car dealership. What they're trying to do inside those stores are dramatically different. And therefore, trying to chase energy savings versus real lighting is not the same thing. And that's where people get very, very confused, and they get lost on this journey. In the pursuit of the energy savings, they sacrifice the lighting. And so where lighting as a service and where FES comes in very well is that we will sit with clients and we will understand what it is they're trying to do, and can we give them a lighting upgrade before ever worrying about energy savings? Because what happens is, in our world, and because we do everything up front for our clients and we lay out all the capital, if they don't have the right lighting, it doesn't matter how much money you're saving them. Client experience trumps any type of energy saving for that potential customer. I'll do the outside of the car dealership. We'll do the service bays, the parking areas, maybe the offices. I don't want to do the showroom. I don't want to be anywhere near the showroom, because if forest green suddenly looks like lime green, you've got a problem. You've got a problem. And by the way, the car dealer didn't need to save 50 cents when he's trying to make forest green look forest green as opposed to racing green. That's not the same green. Now, to the naked eye, maybe it is. And that, so therefore, again, lighting as a soap, you've got to choose where you want to be. And you've got to choose very carefully. And you've got to really know what it is you're doing. Because what upside do you have? Those are the sort of people, when they're buying LEDs, they're not buying LEDs for energy savings. They're buying the LEDs because they need the LED to show forest green looking different to racing green. It's not an energy savings play. It's a, I need these special lights to make my store look better. That's not the same light or the same mentality when he went out to the parking lot and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and he wants the place lit up, like, you know, so you can see it from space, as much for security as it is for the person who's browsing in the middle of the night.
So we talk about the client experience there, but I'm curious if there are other things when you sit down with the customer who's looking to upgrade their lighting for whatever reason there, primarily energy efficiency, of course. What are some other aspects that you look at beyond the customer experience? Is it a matter of looking at maybe how the stores are constructed or maybe more effective ways to light the interior of that retail store to be energy efficient?
Actually, what you tend to find is over time, people have done various types of what I call energy saving upgrades and probably didn't even realize it. So for example, if you imagine in a parking lot outside a store on those 30-foot poles that you just see everywhere with the big brown boxes, back in the day, those would have had 1,000-watt metal halides in them. And they'll give you the right amount of foot candles when you park your car and you're going into all those different retail experiences. Now, again, one of those, you know, facility directors would have come along back in the day and said, oh, you know, we can take down that 1,000 watts. We could put up a 750-watt metal halide. Well, he would have saved 25% in his electricity bill and nobody could tell the difference. And he'd be right. And then over time, someone came along and said, let's take down the 750 and we'll put up a 400. And then the 400 goes up and now they're 60% below where they were. And then someone comes along now and says, oh, look, we can take down that 400. We can give you 150 watts and save again. And everyone gets excited, except to remember that that pole originally was supposed to have 1,000 watts on it. Now somebody's giving you 150 watts on it. So yes, you've created, obviously in this scenario, 85% worth of energy savings over time. But what you've actually done is reduce the light levels that you should have had in that facility for those clients in that particular field. And that's the biggest thing that people don't understand when they go in. As I said before, in the pursuit of energy savings, they don't realize that they don't have them to start with. You can always create saving money. But if that's at the expense of the light levels that you're trying to achieve, and light levels aren't just for one day, they've got to be there for that business for the foreseeable future while they're in business. So consequently, giving them something that's going to reduce the ability to operate while pursuing those savings is a big no-no for us. And so when you say, what do we sit down with clients? It's really to get them to understand what they think they have and what they have and what they need and what they're going to need is not the same thing. And therefore you have to understand what a client is actually trying to achieve in his business on a day-to-day basis and then guide them in the right way. Because of course, everyone gets very excited. Can you save me the money? Well, yes, I can save you the money, but do you want your clients to hate what the experience they're after? Well, no, of course I don't want them to hate that experience. Well, then guess what? You're not saving any money. And in some cases, and particularly in the retail world, I've got many clients where I'll actually turn around and say, you need to go the other way. You need to actually increase the brightness of your lights, increase the wattages of your lights, therefore incurring higher expense in the day-to-day energy bill, but a better client experience.
Now, of course, Future Energy Solutions services a number of clients. So we're not only talking about retailers here, as you mentioned, QSRs and the like, other commercial businesses. And I'm curious, in terms of as you approach these different types of businesses, you mentioned it, sometimes it's about evaluating where that business needs to be in terms of their light. Depending on the space, you mentioned parking lot, interior, et cetera. What are some evaluations that take place in terms of where those businesses should be at in regards to the power and the strength of the light that's there?
Well, again, depending on what type of retail experience you're referring to, firstly, any retailer will actually want the brightest outside area possible. And a lot of times these retailers don't actually own the facility or the site where their stores are. So this therefore means working in conjunction with their landlords to have the best arrival experience possible. Because if a housewife, and you know, it's known, wants to come out and shop at night, she's always going to choose a parking facility that is brighter than one that's darker. We all do. So subsequently, enticing customers into that retail experience, the first thing that actually draws them to it, in a lot of cases, is how they feel when they arrive to park their cars. And a lot of people forget that. What retailers don't appreciate is when you go into a plaza, the plaza owner can't charge more because he put in fancier lights into that plaza. So consequently, shopping plaza owners are actually diametrically opposed to lighting upgrades because, of course, it costs them money to upgrade the plaza. The energy savings goes to the tenants. He doesn't get any benefits. And he normally charges on triple net leases, you know, a fee to pass through the bills in the first place. So a lot of shopping plazas are very much underlit because the landlords really hold off doing these upgrades because it really is no benefit to them. But that is something that's there that is very prevalent, like I said, in the retail world, because lighting is, you know, bringing people into your facility. So much of it is, how do I park? What you find is there's two different types of landlord. You have a landlord that turns around and says, I want my clients to thrive, and I want my clients to have as many savings as they can, because the longer they are there, the more money I can earn, the better it is. And then you have the landlords who straight away look you in the face and say, what's in it for me? They forget that people have choices in this day and age, that there's obviously abilities to go to multiple places in multiple locations. And you will find, and we found this, that people will actually drive further because they feel safer. And that's the first thing that the good lighting is going to do. Now, again, when you get there, the next thing that people don't fully appreciate is you could have a multi-location business and say, well, I want a one-size-fits-all type of lighting for my business. But they're not taking into account that in a lot of instances, no two stores are in the same location. There's other things to take into account. Are you rural? Are you urban? Are you in a neighborhood? What are your neighbors doing? What's going on next door? So when we at Future Energy Solutions look at a potential client, no matter how many sites they've got or wherever they are, we look at them each as individual, unique sites. And everybody's got this preconception, it's all the same, and it's not. No two sites are the same, even if it's the same owner, because one location could back onto a neighborhood and they don't want the light leaking out of those fixtures into somebody's backyard. Then you can have dark sky ordinances. Someplace in Florida, you've got ordinances where, when it comes to, you know, the sea turtles, there's such a wildly different type. You know, you can have airplanes flying over. We once had a site once, I mean, all jokes aside, this is true. We lit it up so well that apparently the airplanes were thinking they were heading towards the landing strip. So we had to change the lights because you start to realize all these different ordinances are actually there for, you know, really good reasons. And therefore, you can't turn around and say, well, you know, I've got a casual dining restaurant and next door, for example, maybe I've got a bank and next door to that, I've got a fashion retailer. Oh, it's all the same because they all occupy the same square footage. They're totally unique. They totally have to be looked at differently. And what they're trying to do inside those businesses are totally unique and have to be looked at individually as well.
You hit on something that I wanted to discuss here. As far as Future Energy Solutions is concerned, it's not enough to just say, okay, well, here's your lights, go and put them in. You design a lighting plan, engineer as needed, order lights as needed, and then install them as needed. And I'm curious, in your experience as a company, what are some of the challenges that you face in terms of installing new lighting fixtures? What are some of the things that you have to kind of overcome? And how are some of the effective ways that you've learned in terms of ease of upgrading certain retailers on the technical side of things in terms of installation?
You know, it comes down to marrying their expectations versus your expectations. So I say to clients all the time, when you're spending your money, good luck. You're going to go out, you're going to do the best you can, you're going to buy some lights that somebody tells you to buy, and you're going to hope that over time they do exactly what you've been told they're going to do. And what does that actually mean? Well, imagine when you buy a new car. If we all bought a new car, 4, 5, 6, 7 brands of new cars, on day one, we put them all on the starting line. They all have that fabulous smell. We're all very excited, and off we all go in our new cars. But if you come back 18 months later and discuss the experience now of how those cars are, everyone will have a different story to tell. And someone's going to turn around and say, my car's as good today as the day I bought it. And someone's going to turn around and say, I wouldn't buy this again if it was the last car on earth. Lighting's very much the same. See, the one thing we try and explain to our clients is the only industry we know they're not in is lighting. And no matter how bright the teams they put around them are, none of them know what the future is going to hold. So when you spend your own capital on lighting and you put your own capital into lighting, you need to know what it is you're expecting those lights to do, which again is how long are they going to keep those levels of the brightness, for example, as you begin, because all lighting has depreciation and it loses its light levels. And consequently, you therefore have to go and buy new lights or maintain the old lights. What does that cost? Then you have the clients that are expecting these massive energy savings, but their operational hours, if they're more successful, can change as well. What does that entail? But then following on from that, how much longer are your lights going to last, or how much less your lights going to last had you now upgraded? And then what are your future financial obligations? Because of course, once you do an energy upgrade, you are buying a significantly more expensive fixture or bulb. So these are the things we battle with our clients all the time. And it comes back to, again, that client expectation. So the beauty of the lighting as a service model that Future Energy Solutions provides is that we de-risk you from all of that. We tell you what's the right light to put inside your facility and we pay for it. And more importantly, we maintain it for the next 15 years, which means from the client standpoint, if we're wrong, if it loses its light levels, if it falls apart, if it was no good, if there's tons of maintenance, that's our problem, not yours. So that's why we provide such a fantastic service to our clients, but that's why you have to be very, very specific what you're doing with those clients when you arrive and make sure that they understand what they want and what we want going forward.
You mentioned maintenance, you mentioned depreciation of the fixtures in certain circumstances. From the outside looking in, from someone that doesn't know anything about lighting whatsoever, other than the need to replace certain fixtures, what are some other forms of maintenance that you come across as far as lighting is concerned?
Well, everybody likes to read what's on the box and just go, oh, you know, these lights are going to last 50,000 hours. And so essentially forever in our world. And, you know, they get all excited because they're going to last forever. They think, oh my word, you know, that means I don't have to replace them forever. When they didn't really fully understand what it was they were buying into. So again, what do manufacturers do for a living? Well, they make things. So if LEDs were going to last as long as everybody seems to think they were going to, what would a manufacturer be doing next? They're just sitting around waiting for these things to die. Well, it's the opposite. Manufacturers need to make things. So therefore LEDs have to have a lifespan. They have to fail, they have to end, and that creates the maintenance. Now, in the regular light bulb world that everybody knows and understands, you have a light bulb, you have a filament, the filament breaks, the light bulb dies, life is over. You go buy another light bulb. And in the old days, you know, you had industry standards on the type of fixture. Therefore, because you have industry standards, you could buy a GE bulb, a Philips bulb, a Sylvania bulb, any brand of bulb you wish, and it would work in your fixtures. Because there was no brand loyalty, you could do whatever you like. Now the LED comes along, and what people don't realize is each one of those LEDs are light bulbs in their own right. And now your fixture that only had one light bulb before now might have 10, 20, 30, several hundred chips inside them to get that same level of brightness, therefore increasing the amounts of failure you can get, which therefore increases the amount of maintenance you're required to do. And maintenance, again, is subjective because as each year goes by, what constitutes failure? How much do I need to go up and down that ladder? How do I claim on my warranty? Warranties are very hard to claim on because the light bulb didn't die like a filament light bulb did. The light bulb still works because there's so many of these chips inside them. But now, as you see, if you look in traffic lights when you drive home, you'll see half a red light, half a green light, the little man crossing the streets lost his arm. Cities can't claim those fixtures. They can't even do the maintenance on those fixtures because red is still red and green is still green and the little man crossing the street is still the little man crossing the street. So maintenance is very much increased. Replacement is very much out there because that's what they need to do with the new improved versions. Warranties and claiming is incredibly difficult because what constitutes failure and then who do you go back to do it for? So it is actually a huge minefield and a huge problem for these companies when they sign up to these energy efficient upgrades. Like I said, if you're looking purely for the energy savings and not looking for the lights to do something different, where therefore the energy savings didn't matter.
Some really fascinating points, and certainly something that if you're not in the lighting industry, you probably don't even think of or don't even know about in terms of maintenance of those LED lights. I wanted to ask you something I was reading about on the Future Energy Solutions blog in terms of energy schedules, and this was mentioned as far as, you know, the overall looking at a holistic view of how a retailer is using energy, of course, but I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit about what an energy schedule is and how they're deployed across different retailers as far as lighting itself is concerned.
Okay, so again, what you'll find is a lot of companies will look at lighting and bundle it together for energy saving purposes because audits are expensive and detailed audits are even more expensive. So when companies go and upgrade their facilities, you know, people will come in and they'll say, right, they'll count the lights and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And they'll take the bill and they'll just basically say, this is how much light you've got, this is how many hours the store's open, and therefore this is what roughly you're spending on electricity, and this is roughly what you're going to save, and so on and so forth. When you do what Future Energy Solutions does in our program, because we are laying out the capital, because we are creating those savings with our capital, because we're going to be partnered with that client for the next 15 years, creating the savings and the maintenance going forward, when we tell a client they're going to save, you know, $119.12, I'm telling you, Trent, that client's looking for $119.12 because everybody gets crazed when they're looking for energy savings. Now, of course, that business's energy bill never went in a straight line to start with. It always fluctuated. But now we're there. They're expecting this fluctuation to magically become a fixed number every month. So it's incredibly important when you do your energy audit and therefore creating the lighting schedule, that you go fixture by fixture for that client, which basically means you're going to break lighting out of their electricity bill line by line. So every area of a business. So for example, if you went to a retail store, well, a retail store can have many different departments in it. It could have, you know, for example, you've got the car park outside, then you've got the back of the car park, then you've got the sides of the building, then you've got the wall packs on the building. You may have floodlights, you may have signs. Then you go inside the store. The store might be broken up. So you have to identify every area of that store, down to the toilets, down to the offices, down to the hallways in the offices, down to maybe the warehouse in the back where they've got storage. Then you break it down into the different storage areas. And why is that important? Because inside those facilities, all those lights are not burning uniform hours. They're just not, even though people like to bundle them together. And if you're going to be as accurate as we have to be, you have to be able to say, pick any item in that store and be able to tell that client what that light bulb is costing them for an hour, a day, a week, a month, to the penny. And that's what we endeavor to do. And that's why the lighting schedule is so important and how complicated it is to do it.
As we wrap it up here, I want you to take a look into your crystal ball, maybe your LED backlit crystal ball in this case. What are some of the developments that might be on the horizon in the next 3 to 5 years as far as lighting is concerned?
Well, you can't just uniformly bundle it all together because, as I said, there really is two different types of lighting. You have what I call white light for people where it's a symptom of their business. And then you have what I call real lighting, where the aesthetic that those lights create are paramount to the operating of that business. Nobody's going to reinvent white light again. So those white lights will still be the same white lights. But when you start moving interiorly and exteriorly where the lighting really matters, the things that you're seeing now in lighting is that, you know, the lights are talking to each other. They're starting to be able to track foot movements. They're going to be able to track, you know, in department stores, you know, which areas of the store are used more, which areas are used less, how many people are going through these stores. When you're parking, they're going to start to be able to work out which direction these people are going into, you know, and whose stores are they going towards. And now imagine as you scale that up, you'll start to know as people park in a parking facility, where do they go in the day? Why do they choose to park in that parking facility? And then which retail store, are they going to that parking facility for that retail experience? And at that retail experience, who in that retail experience are they going to? So that is what's coming in lighting, is the ability inside all those fixtures to network them together and create that ability to get data. Because of course, we live in a data-driven world today. And if you know what your customers and your consumers are looking to do, then you're able to market to them better. And that's where the lighting itself is going, is having that ability to have more stuff inside it.
Just phenomenal insight. We love talking about this stuff on the show, of course. Daniel Gold, once again, founder of Future Energy Solutions. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Daniel for joining us. That's one of the interviews where, you know, honestly, we talked for quite a while, even after the interview, about some interesting dynamics in the space. And I think when you look at retail, everyone is so captivated in a news sense by the buzzwords, you know, omnichannel and the push to digital and more people are buying online and et cetera, et cetera. And we've been kind of micro-focused on the pandemic as a whole, as the retail news community over the past year, but it really is refreshing to take a look at something that, you know, as long as there's brick and mortar stores, those stores have to be lit. And for retailers, they've got to be lit, at least in most cases, efficiently, unless you're looking at product-specific lighting, as Daniel talked about during that interview. But again, a lot of dynamics at play, interaction with landlords as well. So just an interesting topic overall to address, and one that we really haven't talked about in quite some time. I think it's been 3 or 4 years on the podcast since we've discussed that, since we had an interview at NRF with one of the people spearheading the change over to LEDs, in fact, at Walmart back so long ago. Well, let's go ahead and launch our Looking Ahead segment now. And as I mentioned, our Looking Ahead segment has a little bit to do with what we call kind of the Amazon PR machine. It seems like Amazon at this point always in the news for one thing or another, whether it's their brick and mortar stores or some other online development or an issue with employees as they've had over the past couple of months. But this week, it's because Amazon is rolling out a Palm-based payment solution for shoppers in the Seattle area. And that started on Wednesday of this past week. Basically, it is a palm-based reader. It's not a chip in your hand or anything like that, although we did discuss, in fact, on a recent interview that over half of younger generation shoppers would be comfortable with paying with the chip in their hand, by the way. But this system particularly is called Amazon One. Basically, it associates a credit card with their palm print. You would think, in terms of security, very, very difficult to pass off someone else's palm print. Now, this won't use any of Amazon's cashierless technology. A lot of people in the marketplace saying, well, if you do that, you'll eliminate jobs. Not that there isn't cashierless technology at other retailers, of course. But I think the reason I want to look ahead at this story and see kind of where it goes and where it develops is there's two very different types of consumers. And there's this kind of dichotomy that's occurring out there. One type of consumer is okay with paying via any method that is the most secure, not really necessarily worried about their personal data being used by the supermarket, by the retailer, of course, but just looking at convenience. We mentioned the numbers surrounding the chip in your hand, for example, using that to pay, potential issues that could come up with that. You know, younger generations, or a lot of the younger generation, at least, don't really care too much about that. They seek convenience. We've talked also about certainly cardless technology, technology using mobile payments, mobile wallets, and so forth. And then you have another group of consumers, some of whom are still most comfortable using cash for whatever reason. We talked during our interview with Jim Johnson at FIS about how oftentimes people use cash because they feel it helps them budget better and not spend outside their means, which of course would be possible if you're using the credit card that's linked to your palm print here with Whole Foods. But there are some that are becoming increasingly wary of information and data that retailers, and not just retailers, but all businesses have in terms of personal data. This, in terms of the palm print, would be one other piece of data that Amazon would have. Now, you could make an argument, well, it's difficult for Amazon to really do too much with the palm print data. But I know there are people out there that are still kind of wary, still kind of suspicious about that. And as a result, you wonder exactly how this would be taken by customers. Now, at Whole Foods, we'll see how it works in Seattle. In Seattle, generally speaking, at least, you have a populace that is willing to try new products, willing to try new payment methods. Of course, Amazon's brick and mortar stores have already worked out reasonably well there. This going, of course, into Whole Foods in terms of this palm payment technology. So just anxious to see how it works. Anxious to see also any issues that Amazon might find via this technology. And I would wager that probably other retailers won't be too far behind in doing similar type things in the future in terms of payments and hastening that point of sale any way they can. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. We thank Daniel Gold once again for joining us this week. Coming up next week, we'll be joined by Tim Baines of Compatio. Compatio is a company that really helps specialty retailers group products together in an online setting. That doesn't sound like much, but it really is meaningful when you get down to the details. It allows some of these mom and pop brick and mortar stores that are specialized. We'll talk about an example regarding fly fishing and bicycles, but in terms of products that are often sold with one another, not just adjacent products, but products that have to go together, like for example, a bicycle and a tire. He'll talk about how his company in Compatio is helping kind of connect those dots. And he'll talk about use cases as well, where retailers have been able to use this with great effect. And I think this is kind of the next frontier of the whole, well, customers who bought this already bought that you see at Walmart and Target and Amazon and so forth. So really interesting interview coming up for you next week. And until then, we hope you have a great next 7 days.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.